The China in Africa podcast is brought to you in partnership with the Africa-China Reporting Project at Wits University in Johannesburg. The ACRP promotes balanced, considered reporting on China-Africa relations through training programs held throughout the year. More information at africachinareporting.com.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the China in Africa podcast, a proud member of the Seneca Podcast Network. I'm Eric Olander, and as always, I'm joined by CGSP's managing editor, Cobus van Staden, in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good afternoon to you, Cobus.
Good afternoon.
Cobus, there has been a lot of debt news this week, and some really interesting developments have taken place. Some of you may have heard that Zambia made a big breakthrough on Monday when it agreed to restructure $3 billion of Eurobond debt with its private creditors. Now, that was a big hurdle that came after Zambia also finalized a similar deal with its bilateral creditors, including China. So now we're getting very, very close to the finish line. President Hakainde Hichilema said on X that, quote, history has been made. Now, there's one major hurdle left to go through. About $3.5 billion of commercial debt still needs to be restructured, and a lot of that is to Chinese lenders. Among the loans Zambia still needs to revamp are $1.9 billion borrowed from state-owned creditors in China, including the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China and the China Development Bank. So we're close to the finish line, but not quite there yet. Also, in Nigeria, we got some new data from the Debt Management Office. And Cobus, you and I over the years have talked about how the DMO in Abuja is probably the leader in Africa for debt transparency and publishing just excellent data. They revealed that Nigeria's debt obligations to China increased by almost $500 million in the second half of last year to $5.16 billion. Now, be careful of thinking that's all because of new loans. A lot of the debt increases for dollar-denominated debt have gone up because the value of the local currency has gone down. So it's not always because countries are borrowing more money. But just to put the Nigerian debt levels, particularly related to China, in context, because this has come up over the years as a major issue in terms of the debt trap narrative. We've heard a lot about that. Now, consider this, that when we talk about the $5.16 billion, that's only 7% of Nigeria's total $68 billion of debt. And we see the same situation in Kenya, in Ghana, and elsewhere, where the amount of Chinese debt is in the low single digits. And it's always important to keep that in context when measured against the total public debt. Last piece of news, Cobus, before I get your take on some of this. Angola, we talked about João Lourenço's trip to China last week. The president came back with a lot of goodies in his suitcases. But one of them we didn't mention was that he also got a reduction on his monthly payment to the China Development Bank. $200 million less a month will be repaid in loans. That's a restructuring. That is very important because Angola alone accounts for about a third of all Chinese debt in Africa. So, Cobus, lots of movement now on the debt front. It's really important that we talk about debt now, especially in 2024, because there are enormous Eurobond payments that are going to be made this year. And it's also the same year when Chinese and African leaders are going to get together for the upcoming FOCAC summit later this fall. And it doesn't feel like debt is going to be as big of an issue as it was in the past.
Yes, it seems like some of these discussions are being held before FOCAC, possibly in order to not have them cloud FOCAC itself. You know, kind of debt is obviously a huge China-Africa issue, but it isn't only a China-Africa issue, and it isn't only a China issue. You know, like debt is an issue right along the Belt and Road, but it also, Global South debt isn't only a China-related problem. You know, kind of as you were saying, Eurobond debt plays a massive role in debt crises in some African countries, as well as, you know, rising levels of debt throughout the Global South. And it presents a kind of a complicated challenge, I think, to all of these countries who are trying to develop and to China, because also, kind of as we've seen over the last few years in Western countries, China tends to get blamed, whereas kind of Western private lenders' complicity in the problem gets underplayed. You know, so all of this translates into political problems, even if they on the ground are developmental and financial problems.
And this year and next year are especially important for that Eurobond debt that you've talked about, because in 2014 and 2015, a lot of African governments took out 10-year bonds that are now having to be repaid today. And what a lot of governments are doing is like what the Kenyans just did, where they borrowed another $1.5 billion in Eurobond debt to pay off a previous $2 billion Eurobond debt loan. So the Eurobond is really where a lot of the action is to be watching in terms of debt. Let's get a perspective from one of the top experts in the field on this to put this all into some context. We're thrilled to have back our old friend on the show, Professor Tang Xiaoyang, who is chair and a professor in the Department of International Relations at Tsinghua University in Beijing. Professor Tang, it is wonderful to have you back and to speak with you. It's been a while, and thank you for taking the time to join us.
Yeah, thank you, Eric. And also, it's a pleasure to talk to you and Corbus again. It's a good question and also observation of the current debt situation in Africa. And I would say, actually, we see some positive signs as the Eurobond market, they actually are coming back to Cote d'Ivoire, Benin, and Kenya this year. And they are borrowing again. But it's on the one side, it's not a bad thing, because that means the market actually has a new trends or new activities. And also then these countries actually also then are able to attract, are ready to invest newly. But the problem is actually currently the interest rate is so high. And also, as you mentioned, the local currency rate in almost most of the African countries are declining. And this will impose a quite heavy burden for the African countries. And you are right that Kenya, in that case, actually they need to borrow new bonds, which have a much higher interest rate at this time than 10 years ago. But in order to repay the older bonds, they have to borrow these new ones. And that will be also the case for some other African countries. And this is actually concerning. I think the Zambia case, it's actually a good sign for the debt restructuring progressing. But on the other hand, this debt situation in Africa is not really improving in general. And we still need to find an outlet, especially in this very high interest and very strong US dollar economic period. That will be tough for the African countries to find a new investment and a new funding source.
And Professor Tang, too, how do you feel the debt issue is affecting the Belt and Road Initiative more broadly? Are these kind of financial difficulties, particularly the way that Western private debt overlaps with bilateral and market debt from China, does that represent a key challenge to the Belt and Road Initiative from your perspective?
I don't think the overlapping of private creditors and bilateral is an unsolvable problem. I think the most critical problem is the high interest rate and the strong US dollar at this moment. Since most of the debt in Belt and Road, they are denominated. In fact, it's not only in Belt and Road, but in the world, it's denominated mainly by US dollars. Then this creates a very huge financial burden and extra costs for these borrowing countries. So therefore, the borrowing activities in the Belt and Road and in most of these developing countries, they are decreasing very fast. And I would say currently, this economic concern is the major issues, because when you talk about debt trap and this actually is largely debunked. And also a lot of developing countries, they know it's more like political rhetoric. And currently, the main concern is still about economics. And especially then when in this high interest rate period, how can you really make this investment also profitable? Because when the interest rate is already 5% or 7% per year, then you must make the investment maybe 15 or 20% per year profitable, then so that it can repay the interest rate and justify the borrowing. And that makes the lending activity especially difficult.
Just staying with the Belt and Road Initiative, last year marked the 10th anniversary. President Xi Jinping hosted the Belt and Road Forum in Beijing. And really, the Belt and Road now going into its second decade doesn't look at all like it did in the first decade. We're now in this new era called the small and beautiful, or small is beautiful. A lot of the development finance lending that we saw over the past 10 years has gone away, especially in Africa and Latin America. There's a bigger emphasis on private investment rather than state-backed loans. And there's a lot of pressure on the Chinese government now to focus more of its resources on the domestic economy that's encountering some difficulties. When you look back, especially someone of your vantage point, you have had a view across both the world, but also the Chinese political system. What are the key lessons, do you think, that Chinese policymakers learned from the first 10 years that they're going to do differently in the next 10 years?
I think Chinese economic development is always evolving. Unlike the West, Chinese policy also has a lot of consistency. So therefore, I don't think the small and beautiful is a total like a reversal of the previous policies. In fact, the industrialization and this infrastructure construction and this project, they are still valuable. But it just because of the current economic financial market situation in globally, and it's just unrealistic and also unreasonable to land at this point. But I think the Chinese policymakers and also the practitioners, they still pay a lot of attention to the infrastructure project. They try to, even when today they cannot build a new city, they it's unwise to build a lot of new things, but they actually try to improve the older existing projects and try to streamline them and make them more effective.
What do you think, what are the lessons, though, that they've learned? There must be lessons. There has been mistakes that have been made. And when you look back and have conversations with policymakers and scholars, what are some of the lessons that you think they've learned from the first 10 years?
The lessons in China's economic development, it's always about gradualism and experimentalism. But it's actually the lessons is you just try to improve, try to correct the direction according to the ongoing situation. We call it 与时俱进. So you progress with the time. So this is, even when you say, okay, we change, but it's just because of today's new situation. It's also when you talk about China's economic, even domestic economic policy, that's not necessarily people say on the property, real estate sector is now going down. But that doesn't mean this is a mistake to develop a real estate 10 years ago. Because without this real estate and property development, Chinese economy wouldn't be at this stage. The same is also in China-Africa relationship. Without this infrastructure and industrialization, big projects, Africa and China's cooperation wouldn't have the basis for the current further development. But because time has changed, so now the China's policy must also modify. And this modify is actually also in line with its domestic policy. Namely, it focus more on quality. So there's a new word called a new quality productivity force. And this is actually, I think, something will also be applied to the following years on this China-Africa relationship.
Speaking about the China-Africa relationship, I was wondering from your perspective, on a very broad level, where you feel the relationship is now. Like over the last year or so, we've seen, particularly as China's moved into the smallest beautiful era, there's been a lot of comments, you know, kind of around the world being like, oh, you know, China's retreating from Africa, or, you know, the China-Africa relationship is moving away from projects, for example, or moving towards only political engagement, you know, those kind of, you know, characterizations of it. So I was wondering what the Africa-China relationship and landscape looks like from your perspective right now?
So first, some figures. The China-Africa trade, the bilateral trade, reached the peak historical high last year. So therefore, this is already an indication of the ever-strengthening bilateral engagement. And what is reduced is mainly about the lending activities. And in my opinion, that's mainly caused by this unfavorable global financial market situation. And so the small and beautiful doesn't necessarily mean a total like abandoning of this traditional activity, but it means just the in this situation, we may modify a little bit according to the current circumstances and have some new ideas. And I would say that's also doesn't mean we'll be because when the like new the economic conditions in global context is changed, then this will also be again revised. So I think this policy change is more like to respond to the general macroeconomic context instead of like a correction or instead of denying the previous policies.
But when we look at the health chart of the China-Africa relationship, one of the things that we noticed was that foreign direct investment from China to Africa fell sharply last year. That may be in line with the fact that the Chinese economy, again, is slowing and there's some difficulties at home. But also when we look at the trade numbers, yes, they went up about 1.5%. But still, the bulk of the trade between China and Africa for exports from Africa to China is concentrated in just four or five countries, and mostly they're extractives coming from oil, cobalt, minerals, and things like that. It's not a healthy relationship across the continent, and imports from China to Africa went up a lot, causing pressure on trade deficits and also making it more difficult for African countries to industrialize because so many low-cost products are coming in from China. When you look at those facts and those statistics, how do you kind of interpret them in terms of the health of the China-Africa economic relationship?
So first, when you say China import from several major countries, this has been the situation for long term, right? So this is actually Africa's economic structure. They decided that, and it's not a new phenomenon. And when it comes to China's export, actually, these are not low-cost ones. These are actually Chinese, mainly a lot of machinery. And actually, that's related to the investment because China, actually, we know in Africa, now China have this Transion and even BYD. They are setting up factories and projects in Africa. This all, and also a lot of renewable energy. Like in Morocco, we see a lot of green solar power panels and the investment. And also these industry zones in Africa invested by Chinese. Actually, they are still booming and they have already survived even someone like in Ethiopia. They survived a very treacherous domestic political situation and they are able to grow. So even when you see the investment number, but we know actually the FDI statistics is problematic because a lot of them may go through like a Virgin Islands, go through Hong Kong, and go through these tax havens to Africa, or they actually may be reinvested from the Chinese projects there, then further to Africa, its domestic market. But when you go on the ground, because last year I went to Africa after the COVID, what I find is that actually Chinese companies, especially actually the private manufacturing companies, they are more confident of Africa and also more experienced. And I think they are actually the driving force for this export of Chinese machinery and this industry products there. Because when you see the African, their consumer market, today they are not simply like just importing Chinese goods, but they are actually buying their cell phones, which are assembled like in Ethiopia. And China actually have a number of assembly plants in African countries. So the import, they go there, and the import are just components. And then what the African buy is actually the products assembled there. The same is also for plastic and a lot of textile products. They are not totally like imported from China with complete products, but they, the Chinese export to them are just like semi-finished, and they will do the last step or several steps processing in Africa. And I see this actually as a positive step for local industrialization. And China actually saw such a stage of development in the 1980s and the 90s as well.
So, you know, as we mentioned at the top, we're moving towards the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation Summit that's happening later this year. And at the moment, there are all of these preparations happening for the summit. So I was wondering how those preparations work. Like, what are some of the processes that happen in the run-up to the FOCAC Summit?
Yeah, I think first, logistic and the political preparation is certainly going well, and the planning. And I think the government has already announced this FOCAC is going to be a summit as well. So first real gathering of Chinese and African leaders after COVID. Then in terms of more substantial social economic cooperation, I think the government, bilateral governments, they all actually contacting each other. Like what we saw Sierra Leone's president, Angola's president, they all visited China, and then they went to President Lorenzo went to Shandong province to see some industrial projects and want to get this industrial investment in Angola. So these are all I think as a part of this preparation. So even when you see unlike 10 years ago, when actually bilateral relationship has a lot of space to develop, you can see when a president comes, then you will sign a lot of new deals. Today, actually, since the relationship has reached already a certain a mature stage, you won't see a lot of still bigger, huge deals, because people become more, there's not a very obvious vacuum, but you need to actually be more careful in planning, and need to find more projects with higher quality and higher effectiveness. And I think this will be also the ongoing preparation for the FOCAC. This year, perhaps you will see some announcements focusing on innovation, on this new industrial sector, on new energy, also new cooperation forms. I think it's, again, in line with China's overall emphasis on high-quality productive force. Then the China-Africa economic cooperation will also focus more on quality and on innovation.
And when you say quality, what does that mean exactly? That's a very broad term. What's that mean?
Quality, first, it means sustainability also need to be improved. Meanwhile, the technology and the broader social impact, all this part need to be more comprehensively considered. I think in contrast with quantity, which is just means you see a figure, you see the numbers. Quality means you need to think a lot more other than numbers.
And this kind of perspective on this focus on quality, how does that kind of overlap with some of the priorities on the African side? You know, what are some of the things that the African countries would like to achieve, and how are they dovetailed with some of these kind of plans on China's side?
I think Africa, their main interest is also development of their own countries and the welfare of their own people. So therefore, in terms of development, they still may, some African countries, especially in, when they feel tighter in this financing sources, maybe they still will say, I want more funding. But I think also they understand now, in this, financial market conditions, it's just not so easy to go back to this easy funding period. So therefore, then I think they will also think more diverse interests. And they will also then think about a lot of African leaders and also the communities already say the environment concerns. Also then talk about their own skill transfer and about their education and also the local entrepreneurship and how the local businessman can get more involved or become a business partner with Chinese companies. And I think these are the more qualitative concerns, because these are not limited to the investor number or the big loans, but these are more about the real long-term effect, for the also broader impact on the society, on different aspects, on environment, on cultural, on social, etc.
It's interesting you say that about the quality and the de-emphasis of the loans and the numbers, because, you know, back in the 2012 FOCAC and the 2015 FOCAC and even the 2018, it was always these big numbers that were the headline, $20 billion, $60 billion, $60 billion again. And I'm wondering, do you think that the Chinese are going to do that again this year if they want to shift the focus more towards that quality, sustainability, environment, smaller projects, FDI, rather than these massive numbers? Do you think we'll see another big number, or are they going to try and move on from that?
Yeah, it's a good point, because we just saw in 2021, actually Chinese already reduced, it's not a clear reduce, yeah. But they...
It wasn't precise. It was a vague number that they gave in 2021.
Yeah, right. It was vague. Yeah, it's not equivalent. Unlike from 2006 to 2018, it was very clear, increasing tendency until 2015 and 2018, then topped by 60 billion for 2 years. But 2021, then they tried to de-emphasize the number, right? It's not necessarily a decrease, but they just don't want to say, we don't want to go on this direction, quantitative increase direction anymore, because at this stage, we need to think more about the qualitative issues. So I think this actually will be further continued in this year. And I believe so, yeah, because from 2006 to 2000, that doesn't mean 2006 to 2018 was wrong. Actually, going back to your previous question on mistake or lessons, Chinese do not see it in this way, because the emphasis on the numbers, on the loans at that time, that was actually consistent with the growing like a sentiment and with this enthusiasm and the confidence at that time. So that time we needed these numbers to show really the strengthening tie. But it's now actually based on this very solid historical ties. Now we can actually think more about something which do not necessarily be put into numbers. And something beautiful. It's not necessarily small, but it should be beautiful, right? And it should also then not only about the business, it should also talk about society, talk about not only the short term, but think more about long term innovation and technology. And I think this is the new like zeitgeist. Yeah, it's a new spirit of time.
Over the last few years, there's been increasing calls from African countries for external partners to add to industrialization, and particularly for African countries to work together to hit targets, you know, set by bodies like the African Union to increase industrialization. At the same time, there's also from the Chinese government, we've seen the increasingly strong messaging around alternative forms of modernization. You know, like China presenting a model to modernization and different countries having to find their own ways towards modernization. So I was wondering from your perspective how those two things link in the FOCAC space. You know, kind of, are they talking about the same thing when Africans talk about industrialization and Chinese authorities talk about modernization?
I think they are overlapping to a large extent. And because when you read some Chinese officials' statement, they also talk about industrialization. But modernization has a more broader context, and which actually I think the Africans as well are interested in this broader aspects. But they just maybe when they talk to Chinese or they think their priority is industrialization. It's just doesn't mean that they neglect the broader social and cultural transformation. And I think the Chinese discussion on this alternative ways, or every country should have their own path of modernization. This also is consistent, compatible with Africans' interests, because China's idea is actually the target of modernization and the target of industrialization. This is set, but the path, actually every country can have their own path, and there's a diversity and flexibility. And this is exactly the Chinese wisdom in its own development process, namely touching the stones to cross a river. So the river is about the modernization and industrialization, but the real path is actually the touching stones. This is actually rather a contrast with the conditionality imposed by the Western authorities.
Tang Xiaoyang is the chair and a professor in the Department of International Relations at Tsinghua University and one of the foremost scholars on China-Africa relations. What a privilege for us to have a half hour of your time today, Professor Tang. Thank you so much for sharing some of your insights with us.
Thank you. It's a wonderful discussion, Eric and Carlos, and I look forward to talking to you in the future.
It's always such a treat to have the chance to speak with Professor Tang. It's been too long, and I really love getting that view from Beijing, which unfortunately we don't get as much today as we did. But the key takeaway for me is these definitions of these key words. So we heard about quality, industrialization, and modernization. These are three terms that I think if I was to advise an African president or prime minister on how to prepare for FOCAC, I would say you really need to try to understand these words. So quality was very interesting because it had that ESG component to it. It had that sustainability component to it, more engagement with local stakeholders. We've seen this as part of the small is beautiful, smart is beautiful, whatever you want to call it. But that's that word quality. And I'm not sure that that was immediately understandable to everybody on the outside.
Yes. In the first place, of course, China faces an ongoing kind of narrative about low quality, you know, kind of infrastructure, which I think has largely been disproven. You know, I don't think there's any real case to be made that Chinese infrastructure is low quality, but that is a narrative that keeps continuing. So in the first place, that obviously addresses that talking point. But then also, I think it overlaps with the beautiful part of small is beautiful, right? Kind of because I think quality is more than just having the infrastructure itself be high quality. I think the quality also relates to having an impact, like having an actual developmental impact. And there it overlaps with the beautiful part of small is beautiful. And it, you know, kind of one can see in this space something like solar microgrids, for example, would play exactly into this space, you know, kind of because it's relatively contained budget-wise, but it has a really kind of outsized impact, not only on particularly industrialization processes, but also just on broader kind of modernization of the society.
So does that refute a little bit of this idea that there are a bunch of white elephants around the world in the form of the port of Hambantota in Sri Lanka, maybe the SGR in Kenya, that were these enormous BRI projects, which were probably never economically viable from the start. And so this focus on quality also focuses on impact as well. And that's one of the reasons why they're bringing down the scale of the projects.
I think so. And also, you know, kind of sustainability analysis has become a much bigger part of China-Africa relations, you know, as it went on. And I think also that, for example, calling the SGR a white elephant, I think doesn't necessarily make sense.
That's probably not fair. That's been in the pantheon of examples of projects that were not economically sustainable because you just didn't have the population and the industrial base to support a $6 billion railway. Of course, it's being used a lot. It's very active, but it also never fulfilled the original mission of bringing the railway deeper into East Africa. That would have made it more economically viable. So I think that's one of the reasons why people call it the railroad to nowhere, because it stops in Naivasha in the Rift Valley and doesn't go all the way to the Ugandan border. So I see your point, but that's not a white elephant, but it is a questionable project economically or financially.
It's not having the amount of impact that it could be. I mean, it's also one, you know, shouldn't necessarily assume that that project is done. You know, who knows what will happen with it in the future. But like, I think more broadly, I think the point that Professor Tung made, that the projects that keep going and the projects that are just continuing chugging along and, you know, kind of like some of the special economic zones and so on, never get reported on. You know, like in our pantheon of Belt and Road kind of initiative projects in the kind of Anglophone media, one needs to take into account that the ones that really get reported on are the ones with problems, right? Kind of the ones that are working well. So in that sense, like having the full landscape of what all of this Belt and Road Initiative engagement, you know, what their impact was, is going to be a little bit different from cherry picking the ones that are particularly problematic. With the infrastructure provision, there's always problematic ones. Worse, were the kind of sustainability analyses up to scratch? No. In a lot of cases, definitely not. But, you know, kind of that's also, I think, is a classic kind of adaptive learning. You know, kind of as they went through the 2010s, like some of the very kind of agreed examples of these kind of project failures started to kind of become dealt with and started to fade away, you know, so, which isn't to say that all of these projects are successes, far from it. But I think, you know, like the entire landscape, I think, is a little bit more complex than just, you know, kind of like empty space dotted with white elephants, I think.
And what's your take as to whether great power competition with the US and Europe will factor into FOCAC? The United States and Europe, both through the PGII and also the Global Gateway, are now, at least they appear to be taking Africa more seriously. Again, we have to start seeing some projects actually finish, money actually spent, before we can really say that the Europeans and the Americans are engaged in Africa with these initiatives. Nonetheless, do you think that the heightened attention from the US and Europe will change China's planning for FOCAC to put more emphasis on it than they may have otherwise done if the US and Europe weren't there? Or do you feel that maybe that the Chinese have been focused, you know, in their Africa relationship for a long time, absent the US and the Europeans, and they're just going to do what they're going to do?
More the latter, I think. I think attention will obviously be paid, but I think the Africa-China relationship has kind of built up its own logic. And to a large extent, I think it will continue along those processes. You know, I think the difference may be in more rhetoric coming from the US and Europe and from China in response. And it, you know, the fact that there are more competitors and that those competitors are now starting to actually commit actual money, you know, to projects, that changes the scene a little bit, and, you know, and it heightens the stakes. But a lot of those projects are happening on terms set by the Chinese and set by the Africa-China relationship as it's developed over the last two decades. You know, the fact that the Americans are even talking about building railways in Africa, I mean, that is Chinese playbook. You know, kind of, they're not reinventing any kind of wheel there, you know. So in that sense, I think the Africa-China relationship has taken on a kind of a critical mass to a certain extent, where they kind of set the scene and other actors are responding accordingly, I think.
So over the past 20 years of FOCAC, one of the complaints that's emerged from the African side and from outside scholars is that there's an asymmetric relationship between China and Africa, both in terms of the sheer size of China against the entire African continent, but also especially that's magnified when you look at China in individual countries. Do you get the sense that African countries are doing anything to remedy this? Because there's been a lot of talk over the years of African countries grouping together to negotiate as a unit rather than doing bilaterals. There's other talk where they have been wanting to get, you know, regional loans and regional construction projects rather than on an individual basis. Or from what you're seeing, again, as you study this, that African countries haven't made much progress in that, and China is still dealing with a great asymmetric benefit.
Well, I always find it revealing when the asymmetry of the Africa-China relationship is pointed out by Western observers, because obviously Africa's relationship with everywhere is asymmetrical. That is the structural reality of Africa and the world economy, is asymmetry, you know, and frequently kind of extremely valuable things in Africa being sold off for nickels, you know, in the world economy. I mean, China didn't invent that game, you know. So in that sense, you know, this is a larger reality facing the continent in its all its international dealings. And in that context, I think African countries are making significant strides towards integrating a system which, you know, as everyone always points out, 54 countries, very, very complicated. And these were 54 countries who were very used to only fighting for themselves bilaterally. So now they are, you know, under the AFCFTA, for example, they are starting to integrate trade. It's a slow process. But, you know, we're increasingly seeing, I think, regional economic communities, for example, starting to kind of try and kind of think more regionally. And, you know, the Standard Gauge Railway was the classic example of trying to kind of make that work. It's faced many, many problems, many African-made problems, you know, kind of, but not only African-made problems. And, you know, so it's a very slow and very kind of like stop and start kind of process. But that is, I think, the larger trajectory where they're trying to head towards. Are they moving fast enough? I mean, that's a different question. You know, but I think on the African side, that is what they're interested in. On the Chinese side, one can see certain vested interests where negotiating bilaterally just gives China an edge, but also in some ways makes sense logistically. But, you know, it'll be very interesting to see whether there's any kind of real pushback during the FOCAC process.
It's interesting you point out that the asymmetry is universal. Obviously, it's the same when they deal with the European Union and when they deal with the US and other powers as well. So that's a fascinating point to bring out there. Very quickly before we go, and not really related to FOCAC, but just a trend in the critical mineral space that I wanted to run by you. We're seeing these prices for cobalt, lithium, and nickel. These are some of the key metals that go into battery metals. Now down 80%, and we talked about on our show earlier this week on the China Global South podcast that there is a downturn in EV sales in both China and the US, which is really putting pressure on these battery metals. A lot of Western companies are now pulling back on some of their investments. Australian mining companies have started to announce layoffs. There have been some news of US mining companies that were going to go into Africa to mine critical minerals that are now waiting because the prices are too low. At the same time, we're starting to see more headlines coming from Chinese companies, Zijin Mining and Qingshan and CMOC. All three have announced plans to radically expand overseas, to buy up mines. And they're taking advantage. What do they say? Buy on the dip, sell on the high, right? I mean, this is classic business. This is the best time to get into the critical minerals, the battery metal market. This is the time to do it when prices are down 80%. And I just can't believe that others don't see this. And when I was reading the headlines today and I was talking to our colleague in Jakarta, Antonia Timmerman, and she's covering the fact that Qingshan is going to be building new smelters and they're doubling down on nickel in Indonesia. Of course, this makes sense. This is the time to do it. And you know you're going to wake up 5 years from now and the prices are going to be sky high and everybody's going to say, where were we? What did we do wrong? How did we get shut out of this market? Here we are again. It's really amazing. So I just wanted to put that across, everybody, to keep an eye out for, because watch for the headlines of these Chinese mining companies starting to go out there. At the same time, there was also some news that came out that Zijin in particular said that they are expecting to get hit by U.S. sanctions. And they're anticipating that the pressure from the United States is going to bear down on them and really impact their business. So there might be a move right now. One of the strategies that I think might be playing out here is that they're going to take advantage of these low prices to buy as much of the market as they can. And that's then going to box in the Americans on the Inflation Reduction Act, because the Inflation Reduction Act says if you have any Chinese components, particularly battery metals, in your supply chain, you don't get the tax benefits. But if the Chinese are the only place to go for some of these metals, as they are today, then what are you going to do? And it doesn't look like the Americans are moving fast enough on the mining side or on the processing side the way that the Chinese are right now to take advantage of these low prices. Not sure if you have any thoughts on that before we go.
Well, you know, kind of it shows an interesting kind of like tension, I think, between the kind of pressures facing Western companies, particularly short-term pressure from shareholders. I mean, you know, to demonstrate shareholder profit within the quarter or within the year, compared to a kind of a longer game, you know, played by the Chinese industry. It will also, I think, all of these kind of EV fights and EV bans and possible tariffs and so on, and the panic in Europe around, like, you know, kind of large scale imports from China and so on. All of that is going to be, I think, is going to play out, or it's going to be revealing, I think, in the long run, you know, kind of in differentiating the market power of Europe and the US compared to their political, symbolic, and other kinds of power, like military power and so on. You know, obviously these are massively powerful countries, like incredibly powerful countries, but they also have relatively small populations. So when you then compare, you know, the 1.3 million Africans, 1.4 million Indians, 1.2 billion, I mean, like, what, you know, in these populations in the billions across the global south, compared to rich, albeit extremely rich, but kind of like in the hundreds of millions kind of populations in Europe and the US, the EV market, kind of this kind of calculus is going to be interesting to, as just a kind of an indicator of where global markets are lying, you know, kind of. And I think there seems to be a calculus on the Chinese side that you can make a very tidy profit, particularly if you target your models well, by selling, you know, at the low end of the market around the world. And they may be right, they may be wrong, who knows? But, like, you know, it's going to be an interesting situation where one sees a split emerging between the political power represented by Western countries and the actual market power represented by them, particularly as the wealth gaps in those countries get more and more, you know, kind of like stretched wider and wider, as there's more and more kind of cost of living kind of tensions within places like the UK, for example. All of that's going to be quite revealing, I think, and how these markets shake out against markets like Indonesia or India, for example.
I think it's a little bit like an Apple-Android thing. So Android sells way more numbers, and a lot of that coming from places in the global south. Apple, though, sells many fewer phones, but captures the lion's share of the profits for the mobile phone market.
Yeah, and I mean, Tesla is the great example, is the Apple of EVs, right?
Same thing. So you might have some brands catering into the G7 countries, which will scoop up most of the profits, but the volume will be made up in the rest.
Yeah, what I think would be more interesting in the EV side is that on the EV side, I think that translates into many different, like a broader range of different models than on the phone side. You know, kind of like this, like EVs, like when you actually go to China and you walk around on Chinese streets, the kind of EVs you see there are things that simultaneously you don't see in the US ever. You never see those like little electric, like three-wheel little flatbed, micro flatbed trucks that with like a square meter of flatbed at the end, for example, that you see frequently in China. Those would be super, super useful in Africa. So there's a range of things produced where some like whole kind of like product categories don't even show up in Europe and the US, you know, but they will definitely show up everywhere else. So that's going to be very interesting.
No, absolutely. And we're seeing it here in my neighborhoods in Ho Chi Minh City. The Chinese vehicles are coming in. The Chinese scooters are starting to come in. I don't think it's going to be long before the tricycles that you talked about with these little flatbeds are going to start displacing the gas-powered tricycles that really move a lot of the Vietnamese economy around every day. I can tell you firsthand, this has happened. It is happening right now. And it's not happening in Europe or the US. I was just in Turkey last week. It's not happening there either. but it is certainly happening in less developed countries where you can see Chinese mobility solutions are taking hold. There's no doubt about it. I mean, it's just happening. So let's leave the conversation there. Cobus, thank you as always. It's always so much fun for us to get together. 15 years of doing this and it still isn't boring. Listen, Professor Tang is a subscriber to the China Global South Project and we thank him for that. He gets our newsletter every day. He's reading us every day in the work that Giraud and Cobus and Johnny and Antoni are doing. It's really such a great service. And if you'd like to join Professor Tang and thousands of scholars and diplomats and university libraries around the world, business folks, activists, we've got just a really impressive readership now. And we just would love to have you join our community. Go to ChinaGlobalSouth.com/subscribe. Subscriptions are very affordable. We've kept it that way. It's meant to be accessible. Cobus, I was looking at a German publication today that covers China, and they charge 199 euros a month. A month.
Yeah.
And so just amazing, you know, but they're offering a lot, but still, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, everyone's trying out these different models, but I think, you know, ours really go for accessibility.
That's really the priority here. And so we're $199 a year or $19 a month. And if you are a student or teacher anywhere in the world and you would like to get half off, just email me with your academic email at eric@chinaglobalsouth.com, and I will send you the links for those discounts. So that'll do it for this edition of the show. Cobus and I will be back again next week with another episode of the China in Africa podcast. Until then, thank you so much for listening.
The discussion continues online. Tag us on Twitter at ChinaGSProject and visit us at ChinaGlobalSouth.com. If you speak French, check out our full coverage at projetafriquechine.com and AfriqueChine on Twitter. That's Afrique with a K. And you'll also find links to our sites and social media channels in Arabic.